We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is the binge-worthy mobile puzzle game. Download Best Fiends for free from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Enjoy the show! August 10th, 1991. Martinsburg, West Virginia. The nude body of 44-year-old freelance investigative journalist Danny Castellaro is discovered in the bathtub of his hotel room. Each of his wrists have been slashed multiple times, but since a suicide note is found and there is no evidence of foul play, Danny's death is ruled to be a suicide. Prior to his death, Danny claimed that he was working on a massive story about widespread government corruption, which he titled The Octopus, and had traveled to Martinsburg to meet a source who would provide important information. Since the investigation uncovers a number of suspicious discrepancies, Danny's loved ones believe he was murdered and that a cover-up took place, but there are no conclusive answers about what happened. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I'm finally going to be tackling a case which I've been wanting to cover on this podcast for a long, long time. The unexplained 1991 death of Danny Castellaro. Or rather, we're going to explore the bizarre conspiracy known as the Octopus. This case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and has always been one of my most highly requested cases since the inception of this podcast, but the whole thing is such a massive rabbit hole containing a wealth of information, I had to make sure I was in the right frame of mind before I took this on. And as a result, this is going to be one of our longest standalone episodes. Danny Castellaro was a freelance investigative journalist who decided to take on a story involving stolen software, but the whole endeavor wound up becoming much bigger than he ever could have imagined. Castellaro eventually came to believe that he had uncovered evidence of an international cabal which he named the Octopus because it was controlled by 8 powerful men who all had the ability to sink their tentacles into any government around the world. After performing his own independent investigation for a year, Castellaro claimed he was planning to meet an important source in Martinsburg, West Virginia, who might provide him with the necessary information to break his story, but instead, he would be found dead in a hotel bathtub with his wrist slashed. Even though the authorities ruled that Danny's death was a suicide, his friends and family disagreed, as he was apparently so squeamish about blood and needles that they could not comprehend the idea of him slashing his wrists several times. Indeed, the original investigation was so mishandled that it gave Danny's loved ones the impression that he was the victim of foul play and that a massive cover-up took place. Regardless of whether you believe Danny was murdered or he really did take his own life, there are a lot of odd discrepancies and bizarre details which have never been adequately explained. I'll state right up front that this story is rife with conspiracy theories, so one of the biggest challenges of putting together this episode was trying to figure out which sources out there are reliable and which ones are nothing more than sensationalistic nonsense. But I've done my best to try and provide the most fair and balanced look at Danny Castellaro's death that I could manage. There's a lot of material to get through, so brace yourself for a wild and lengthy ride. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now venture down the rabbit hole and delve into the suspicious death of Danny Castellaro. Our story begins in 1991, and our central figure is 44-year-old Joseph Daniel Casalero, who goes by the name Danny. Originally born in McLean, Virginia, Danny hailed from a prominent upper-class family and was the second oldest of seven children. During the late 1960s, he decided to attend Providence College in Rhode Island in order to pursue a degree in journalism, but he showed signs of his adventurous spirit when he made the abrupt decision to drop out in order to travel to Ecuador and spend 6 months on an unsuccessful attempt to search for Incan treasure. When Danny returned, he got married to a former West Virginia beauty queen named Terrell Pace, and the couple had a son named Joseph Daniel Casalero Jr., though he always went by his nickname, Trey. Danny and Terrell's marriage lasted for 13 years before it ended in divorce, and Danny wound up getting custody of Trey. Throughout the 1970s, Danny worked as a freelance reporter who mostly wrote for tabloids such as the National Enquirer, as well as computer industry trade publications. However, Danny developed such an interest in information technology that he decided to personally acquire one of the companies he wrote for, Computer Age Publications, taking out a second mortgage on his home in order to purchase it. But by the time 1990 rolled around, Danny was being contacted by the IRS about back taxes that the company's previous owner had not paid, so Danny was forced to sell Computer Age Publications at a loss. While he briefly attempted to continue working there as a writer for the company's new owners, he had trouble adjusting to the situation and was forced out. So Danny decided to take a crack at freelance investigative journalism again, and became particularly interested in a scandal involving a Washington, D.C.-based information technology company called the Institute for Law and Social Research, a.k.a. INSLAW Incorporated. The full details of the INSLAW scandal are far too complicated to get into here, and would probably require an entire long-form podcast, but it all started when INSLAW developed a case management software called the Prosecutor's Management Information System, a.k.a. PROMISE. In 1982, INSLAW licensed PROMISE to the United States Department of Justice, a.k.a. the DOJ, so they could use the software to organize the millions of paper hard copy case files they had at that time. The two parties had signed a three-year, $10 million contract, but after only 1 year, the DOJ started withholding their PROMISE payments to INSLAW, and the company was eventually forced to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. If that wasn't enough, INSLAW also learned that the DOJ had illegally sold PROMISE to the Canadian government without their knowledge or consent. This prompted INSLAW to file a lawsuit against the DOJ, and in 1987, a federal bankruptcy judge ruled in INSLAW's favor. He stated that the DOJ had taken PROMISE from INSLAW through, quote-unquote, trickery, fraud, and deceit, and he ordered them to pay nearly $8 million in licensing fees and legal expenses. Well, by August of 1990, INSLAW had still not received any of that money since the DOJ had appealed the ruling, and when Danny Casalero got wind of this story, he arranged a meeting with INSLAW's founders, Bill and Nancy Hamilton. The Hamiltons would show Casalero a 12-page memo they had received from an electronics and computer expert named Michael Reconosciuto, who claimed he had worked for the CIA on a number of top-secret projects. Reconosciuto is a pretty colorful character, to say the least, and I'll delve further into his backstory later on, but for now, I'll share this quote from journalist Ron Rosenbaum, who published an extensive article about Danny Casalero's death in Vanity Fair in December of 1991. He wrote, quote, "The moment he got his hands on that maddening memo, with its maze of illusion and reality, was the moment Danny's life changed, and he began his descent into the obsession that would lead to his death. He was slowly, then rapidly, sucked into kind of a covert ops version of Dungeons & Dragons, with that memo as his guide, and Michael Reconosciuto as his dungeon master," end quote. Reconosciuto told the Hamiltons that the Department of Justice had hired him to make modifications to the PROMISE software after they acquired it from INSLAW. According to Reconosciuto, he had installed what he described as, quote-unquote, backdoors into the software, which meant that if the DOJ or the CIA sold PROMISE to a foreign government, they could use this backdoor to spy on them and access their computer systems. After Danny Casalero started interviewing Reconosciuto, he learned about a number of shocking allegations and conspiracies, which made him believe that his story about the INSLAW scandal was much bigger than he anticipated. As an example, many of you are probably familiar with the Iran hostage crisis from November of 1979, where 52 United States diplomats and citizens were taken hostage by militarized Iranian extremists at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, leading to a standoff which lasted a total of 444 days before the hostages were finally released in January of 1981. This crisis has always been surrounded by a conspiracy theory known as the October Surprise, which alleges that Iranian officials were bribed into not releasing the hostages until after Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter in the 1980 U.S. presidential election. Well, Rakan Ashuto claimed that this conspiracy theory was 100% true and had been orchestrated by Earl Bryan, who had worked as the Secretary of Health and Welfare under Ronald Reagan while he was governor of California and became director of a consulting firm named Hadron Incorporated. After Hadron paid $40 million to Iranian officials not to release the hostages, the Reagan administration would reward the company by allowing them to profit from the illegal distribution of the Promise software. Now, Earl Bryan would always deny these allegations Rakan Ashuto made against him, and no evidence was ever found to support them, but they definitely compelled Casolaro to keep pursuing the story. Over the course of the next year, this story became a complete obsession for Casolaro, who devoted all his time and energy to it, and would sometimes work as much as 16 hours per day. He eventually came to believe that the Inslaw affair was just one of many scandals that were orchestrated by an international cabal who were responsible for such scandals as the October Surprise, the Iran-Contra affair, and the collapse of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Casolaro believed that this criminal network dated all the way back to the early 1950s, and while it involved numerous U.S. officials, intelligence agents, and members of organized crime, it was run primarily by eight men. Here is how Casolaro described the cabal in a book proposal. Quote, "This is the story of eight men whose real-life impossible mission intrigues have dominated key events that span the globe for nearly half a century. They are the men who make up the octopus. They are not government officials, but their tentacles can reach into any part of government in almost any country, including legitimate and rogue spy networks." End quote. While Casolaro continued working on this story, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee had opened up a formal inquest into the Inslaw scandal. On March 21, 1991, Michael Rakan Ashuto agreed to submit an affidavit to the committee, in which he repeated his allegations about the Department of Justice installing back doors in the Promise software in order to help them spy on foreign governments. Rakan Ashuto also claimed that these modifications to the software had taken place at a lab located on the Cabazon Native American Reservation in California. This site was specifically chosen because the reservation was sovereign territory, so there was no government regulation or oversight, and trying to enforce American law there might be complicated. In addition, Rakan Ashuto said that the reservation had been used by a private security company called the Wackenhut Corporation in order to develop chemical and biowarfare weapons. Well, on March the 29th, just 8 days after submitting his affidavit, Rakan Ashuto was arrested in Tacoma, Washington, on 10 different drug charges, which involved the manufacture, possession, and distribution of methamphetamine and methadone. He later wound up being convicted and received a 25-year prison sentence. In spite of this, Rakan Ashuto maintained that the DOJ had set him up and framed him as retaliation for his testimony. In May of that year, Inslaw would suffer another setback when the U.S. Court of Appeals overturned the nearly $8 million ruling which had been made in their favor against the DOJ. The decision was based on a technicality, as the Court of Appeals ruled that the case should have been tried in federal district court instead of bankruptcy court. The Supreme Court declined Inslaw's request to hear the case, and it would ultimately be referred to the Court of Federal Claims, who ruled against Inslaw years later. Well, by the summer of 1991, Danny was living alone in a rural home in Fairfax County, Virginia, as his son Trey had since moved to Colorado. He was still spending most of his time working on his mammoth octopus story and hoping to use his findings to garner a book deal. On August the 5th, Danny had a conversation with his brother, Tony Casolaro, and told him that because of his investigation, he had been receiving a number of harassing and threatening phone calls at all hours of the night. Danny also said that within the next few days, he was planning to leave on a trip to Martinsburg, West Virginia to meet up with a source who would provide him with important information which could blow his story wide open. Danny then told Tony that if anything happened to him while he was in Martinsburg, he should not believe it was an accident. Well, sure enough, Danny arrived in Martinsburg 3 days later on August the 8th and checked into room 517 at the Sheraton Inn alongside Interstate 81 at around noon. He was planning to return home the following day and attend a birthday party for his niece, taking place at his mother's residence in Arlington. However, on August the 9th, Danny decided to extend his stay at the hotel by one night, and around 6 p.m., he called his mother's house from a payphone to say that he was still in Martinsburg and would likely be late for the party, if he even made it at all. But this would turn out to be the last time Danny's family ever heard from him. At 12:51 p.m. on Saturday, August the 10th, Danny had still not checked out, and when a housekeeper showed up at room 517 and knocked on the door, there was no answer. When the housekeeper unlocked the door and walked inside, she was shocked to discover that blood was spattered all over the bathroom and Danny's nude body was lying in some water in the bathtub. The Martinsburg Police Department were soon summoned to the scene, and when they examined Danny's body, they noticed that both of his wrists had been slashed. He had 4 slash wounds on his right wrist and 8 wounds on his left wrist, and one of these cuts was so deep that it severed a tendon. Danny also had a shoelace tied around his neck, and a second shoelace, as well as a pair of white plastic trash bags, were floating in the water. Other items in and around the bathroom included a half-empty wine bottle, a broken drinking glass, a paper coaster, an ashtray, and a single-edged X-Acto razor blade. An empty Milwaukee beer can was also found in the bathroom, and 5 other beer cans were inside a trash can. But even though the bathroom was a bloodbath, the hotel room itself was very clean, and Danny's wallet, which contained cash and credit cards, was still there. A handwritten note which had been torn from a legal pad was on the desk, and it read, quote, "To my loved ones, please forgive me, most especially my son, and be understanding, God will let me in," end quote. Handwriting analysis would later conclude that Danny likely wrote the note himself, and his fingerprints were the only ones found on the paper. Given the evidence, the Martinsburg PD immediately ruled that Danny's death was a suicide. However, when the Casalero family learned about what happened, they immediately became skeptical of the suicide ruling, particularly since the authorities did not inform them about Danny's death until Monday, August the 12th, 2 days after his body was found. Furthermore, after Danny's body was removed from the hotel room, it was taken to a local funeral home and embalmed without the family's consent. Even though no autopsy had been performed, and embalming a body without informing next of kin was illegal in West Virginia. It wasn't long before Danny's death received nationwide media coverage in a number of newspapers, and the public pressure prompted the West Virginia Deputy Chief Medical Examiner to finally perform an autopsy on Danny. Since Danny's body had been embalmed, there was concern that this might taint the accuracy of the blood and tissue tests, but a blood sample had been taken from Danny's heart before the embalming took place, as well as samples of urine, vitreous fluid, and his liver. The autopsy showed that he had an alcohol content of 0.04 in his urine, and no trace of alcohol in the blood sample from his heart, but trace amounts of Vicodin and a tricyclic antidepressant were found in the samples. Danny had actually been prescribed Vicodin after undergoing oral surgery 3 years earlier, and the empty bottle for it was found in his suitcase. But Danny's family was confused about the presence of the antidepressant, as they did not believe he was on any medication of that sort, and no bottles or prescriptions for any antidepressants were found in the room or Danny's personal possessions. In spite of this, the deputy chief medical examiner still concluded that Danny's death was a suicide, as no trace of any additional drugs were found in his system or the half-empty wine bottle from the bathroom to suggest he had been incapacitated by a third party. Danny's approximate time of death was estimated to be sometime between 7 and 8 a.m. on the morning of August the 10th, approximately 5 or 6 hours before his body was found. But there was additional controversy surrounding the investigation by the Martinsburg PD, as due to their initial suicide ruling, they did not seal off the room as a crime scene. Furthermore, none of the bathwater from the tub was saved as potential evidence, and when the tub was emptied, a strainer was not used to prevent any potential debris from going down the drain. While detectives did return to the room 2 days after Danny's death in order to perform a further investigation, they said they did not find any evidence of foul play. Aside from one unidentified print on the bottom of an ashtray, the only prints which could be found in the bathroom were Danny's. Since the authorities were satisfied that no homicide had taken place, a professional cleaning crew was brought in to clean up the scene. While Danny's friends and family remained unconvinced that he had died by suicide, as they claimed that he had shown no outward signs of depression prior to his death. They found it hard to imagine that Danny would have taken his own life by slashing his wrists a dozen times, as he had a lifelong fear of needles and was always squeamish over the sight of blood. Furthermore, the Casolaro family had also experienced a lot of personal tragedy and lost two other children before Danny. One of them was an infant named Chris, who died of a heart defect only 6 months after birth in March of 1962, and the other was Danny's sister Lisa, who died of a drug overdose in December of 1971 at the age of 18. It could not be conclusively determined if Lisa's death was accidental or a suicide, but Danny was left pretty devastated by her loss, and his family did not believe he would have allowed them to experience that level of pain again by taking his own life. Danny's loved ones decided to backtrack his movements during the last days of his life to try and figure out what happened. On August the 6th, Danny had asked Olga Makros, the housekeeper at his residence in Fairfax County, to help him pack a black leather tote bag for his trip to Martinsburg. She also noticed that he was packing papers into a briefcase, which appeared to be documents from his investigation, and when Olga briefly lifted it up, she said the briefcase was heavy. 3 days later, while Danny was in Martinsburg, Olga claimed that she received a series of threatening phone calls at his residence. During the first call, she heard an anonymous male say, quote, "I will cut his body and throw it to the sharks," and 1 hour later, Olga answered a call from a second man who said, quote, "Drop dead." Over the course of the rest of the day, Olga then said she received 3 more phone calls in which no one spoke, but she thought she heard music playing on a radio in the background during the first 2 calls, while the 3rd call was nothing but silence. Olga claimed she received 1 more phone call at the residence from a man who said, quote, "You're dead, you son of a bitch," and this call took place at 8:30 p.m. on August the 10th, just under 8 hours after Danny's body was found. It was established that Danny checked into the Sheraton Inn in Martinsburg on August the 8th, and several witnesses would place him at the hotel's cocktail lounge, Heatherfield's, for several hours that evening. However, there would be contradictory accounts from the bartender and one of the waitresses at the establishment. While the bartender only recalled seeing Danny there alone and in the company of another man I'm going to mention momentarily, the waitress claimed he was sitting at a table with an unidentified dark-skinned man whom she believed was either Arab or Iranian. She distinctly remembered this man because he complained that the service was too slow and Danny apologized on his behalf. This sighting was particularly interesting because Olga had reported seeing Danny speaking with a dark-skinned man in the kitchen of his residence on August the 5th, but she never found out who this man was. Now, the other man Danny was seen in the bar with was a hotel guest named Mike Looney, who was staying in the room next to Danny's. The two men spent quite a few hours chatting and drinking in Heatherfield's together, and Looney said that Danny told him about the octopus story he was working on. He said he was waiting to meet an Arab who could help him crack the case, and became very agitated when they didn't show up. At one point, Danny excused himself, possibly to go make a phone call, but when he returned a few minutes later, he told Looney that his source wasn't as valuable as he thought and would only be able to provide him with travel documents. The two men then spent the rest of the evening at the bar together until it closed at 11:30 p.m. The following day, on August the 9th, Danny extended his stay at the Sheraton Inn for an additional night, and sometime that afternoon, he had a meeting inside his car in the hotel parking lot with William Turner, a former aerospace engineer with the defense contractor, the Hughes Aircraft Company. Turner had worked at their local defense plant, but was recently fired for whistleblowing, and claimed that he provided Casolaro with some documents about the mismanagement of funds between the Hughes Aircraft Company and the Pentagon. After Casolaro and Turner went their separate ways, Danny was next seen at a local restaurant called the Stone Crab Inn, where he sat at the bar drinking from around 2:30 to 5 p.m. The bartender described Danny as looking lonely and depressed, and Danny even told him that he had a quote-unquote rough night. Of course, Danny called his mother's residence from a payphone at 6 p.m. to let his family know he would probably be late and not make it to his niece's birthday party, but the last confirmed sighting of him took place when he bought coffee at a nearby convenience store shortly after midnight on August the 10th. The empty coffee cup would be found in the hotel room trash can, but no witnesses could account for Danny's whereabouts during the 12-hour window between when he left the convenience store and his body was discovered. But one detail which troubled the Casolaro family is that the briefcase Danny had brought to Martinsburg containing his papers and research was not found in his room or his car. In fact, the briefcase could not be found anywhere, and the documents William Turner had provided to him were also missing. Another odd incident took place at around 4 p.m. on Sunday, August the 11th, when Dan Bischoff, the national affairs editor of the Village Voice in New York City, received an anonymous phone call advising him to look into the death of a journalist in West Virginia who had been investigating the October surprise conspiracy. While Danny's body had already been found at this point, his death would not be reported in the media and become public knowledge until the following day. At the time this call took place, very few people were aware about what happened to Danny, so Bischoff wondered how this caller could have known. Things got even weirder when Danny's funeral took place at Columbia Gardens Cemetery in Arlington on August the 16th. While Danny's casket was being lowered into the ground, a limousine suddenly showed up, and a highly decorated black man dressed in a military officer's uniform emerged from it. He was accompanied by a white man in a tan overcoat who appeared to be a bodyguard, and without saying anything to anybody, the military man walked over to Danny's casket, placed a medal on the lid, and saluted before walking away. After Danny was laid to rest, all of the attendees from the funeral went to a gathering at his mother's house and talked about the military man, but no one had any idea who he was, and he has never been identified. The whole situation was pretty baffling, since Danny had never served in the military at any point in his life. Since the controversy surrounding the handling of Danny's death would not go away, the West Virginia authorities decided to convene a formal inquest, and in January of 1992, the West Virginia State Medical Examiner's Office would exhume Danny's body in order to perform a second autopsy on him. The Martinsburg Police Department also agreed to reopen the case, but in the end, both the new investigation and the autopsy concurred with the original suicide ruling. A new examination of Danny's brain would discover that he had developed possible symptoms of the early stages of multiple sclerosis. This came as a big surprise to Danny's family, who were completely unaware of this, but it turned out that prior to his death, Danny had taken the initiative to approach a nursing teacher friend of his to inquire about the symptoms of multiple sclerosis and brain diseases. Even though she told Danny that the degree of severity appeared to be minor, and she did not believe he appeared to be overly concerned about it, this was seen as another potential motive for suicide. But curiously, this autopsy would uncover some new injuries on Danny's body, including unexplained bruises on the top of Danny's head and his left anterior bicep, and the tips of three of the fingernails on his right hand have been chewed off. The medical examiner seemed to believe that the bruise on Danny's bicep occurred 2 days prior to his death, and theorized that he may have chewed the tips of his fingernails off on his own, though his family insisted that Danny never bit his nails. The autopsy also concluded that there were no hesitation marks near the cuts on Danny's wrists, but even though a tendon had been slashed on Danny's left wrist, he was right-handed, and the medical examiner concluded that the severed tendon would not have deprived Danny of his motor ability to grasp the razor in his left hand and make the cuts on his right wrist. The House Judiciary Committee recommended that an independent counsel perform a new investigation into the Inslaw scandal, so Attorney General William Barr appointed a retired federal judge named Nicholas Bua as special counsel for this. In March of 1993, he would release a report about his findings titled the Bua Report, which concluded that there was no merit to the allegations that the Department of Justice had stolen the Promise software from Inslaw. There was also a new investigation into Danny Casalero's death, and the Bua Report contained a lengthy section which concurred with the original ruling that Casalero's death was a suicide. As part of his investigation, Bua had contacted the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime and requested that they perform a psychological autopsy on Casalero. Three FBI behavioral scientists would research Casalero's background and ultimately came to the conclusion that while he, quote-unquote, wore the facade of the eternal optimist, deep down inside he may have perceived himself as a failure as an author, an investigative reporter, a husband, a father, and as a businessman, end quote. Indeed, they suspected that Danny may have become disillusioned over the fact that his year-long investigation into the mysterious octopus was taking him nowhere, and this prompted him to end his own life. Prior to his death, Danny told friends of his that Time magazine had assigned him to write an article about the octopus conspiracy, and he would be working alongside Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jack Anderson. He also said that publishers Little Brown & Company and Time Warner had agreed to finance his investigation, and he would turn his story into a book titled The Octopus. Well, all these claims were proven to be false, as Danny had no luck getting any publishers to finance his book. In fact, months before he shared this story, Little Brown had actually rejected Danny's proposal for a book because they considered it to be unprofessional, and their top editor, Roger Donald, stated, quote, "I'll tell you this, anybody who killed him over that manuscript made a mistake. That was not a book that was going to be published," end quote. Danny also had a balloon mortgage payment of over $178,000 due on his house at the time of his death, and while the mortgage company had granted him a 30-day extension until September the 8th, it seemed very unlikely that Danny would be able to pay it unless he received a substantial advance to write his book, and it did not seem like this was going to happen. In fact, Danny had recently written a letter to his agent in which he said, quote, "In September, I'll be looking into the face of an oncoming train," end quote. However, Danny's family did not believe his financial issues would have been a motive for suicide, as he had borrowed money from them in the past, and knew that he could always count on them for financial support. And on the morning he left on his trip to Martinsburg, he stopped by his insurance agent's office and paid his homeowner's premium, which did not seem like the actions of a man who was planning to end his own life. In addition, he also phoned a friend of his to arrange a meeting with someone the following week. But putting aside Danny's state of mind at the time of his death, the Boole report still believed that the evidence from the scene supported the original suicide ruling. The X-Acto razor blade used to slash Danny's wrists had actually been part of a package containing four other razor blades, which was found inside the hotel room. Since a shoelace was wrapped around Danny's neck, and two plastic trash bags were found floating in the bathtub, it was theorized that Danny initially made a failed attempt to asphyxiate himself by tying one of the bags around his head, but then decided to slash his wrists instead. Furthermore, the hotel rooms adjacent to Danny's were occupied by Mike Looney and an elderly couple, but none of them reported hearing any noise or anything suspicious or unusual on the date Danny died to suggest that an outside party had entered his room and committed murder. Well, in January of 1993, journalist John Connolly would publish a new article about the case for Spy magazine, which contained some new details which had not been shared publicly before. Barbara Bittinger, the assistant head housekeeper from the Sheraton, would claim that when Danny's body was first found, she noticed two bloody towels in the bathroom under the sink. There were also smear marks on the floor, which gave Bittinger the impression that someone had attempted to use the towels to clean the blood, possibly with their foot, but these towels were not photographed or mentioned in the original police reports. The Spy magazine article would also feature a statement from Ernie Harrison, one of the employees from the cleaning company which had been hired to clean the room, and he would confirm finding some blood-stained towels on the bathroom floor underneath the sink. He subsequently picked up the towels and tossed them away, and they were never examined as potential evidence. 2 months following the release of this article, the case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. The segment went over all the suspicious discrepancies surrounding Danny's death, but West Virginia authorities and representatives from the Department of Justice declined to participate in the broadcast. In 2008, one of Danny's cousins, Dominic Orlando, decided to dramatize his story by writing a stage play titled Danny Casolaro Died for You, which was performed at the Timeline Theater in Chicago. Over the years, a total of 2 books have also been published about this story, The Octopus, Secret Government, and The Death of Danny Casolaro, which was written by Jim Keith and Ken Thomas and came out in 1996, and The Last Circle, Danny Casolaro's Investigation into the Octopus and the Promise Software Scandal, which was written by Cara Seymour and released in 2010. Both books offered in-depth looks at all the conspiracy theories surrounding this case, but even though it has been heavily analyzed and dissected these past 3 decades, the original suicide ruling has never been changed, so controversy continues to surround the death of Danny Casolaro. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. If there's one annoying trend that I've experienced way too much these past few months, it's power outages. I experienced one of them while hanging out and chatting with friends, but then all of a sudden, they noticed I was gone and started wondering if the trail had gone cold for yours truly. But they didn't need to worry, because I just snuck off for a few moments to play Best Fiends. If you're having as much fun with Best Fiends as I am, it's no secret why you sneak off to play. Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game which contains thousands of exciting levels for new adventures and challenges every time you play. There are dozens of unique fiends to collect, so you can customize your team of fiends to defeat menacing slugs. In fact, one of its best features is that it has the option for offline play, which will allow you to keep playing even if you experience one of my numerous power outages and lose your internet connection. Best Fiends is definitely one of the best ways to de-stress when I'm not writing, researching, and recording this podcast. I'm edging ever so closer to reaching my 3-year anniversary of playing Best Fiends, and I'm currently on level number 4800, which means I'll hit the historic milestone of level 5000 very soon. I cannot wait to update you about that, and if you're not one already, I hope you will become a Best Fiends fan as well. So download Best Fiends for free from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. Hi there, I would just like to take a few moments to give a shout-out to another podcast titled Wrongful Conviction. Hosted by celebrated criminal justice reform advocate and founding board member of the Innocence Project, Jason Flom, and by Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast host and producer, Maggie Freeling, Wrongful Conviction features intimate conversations with men and women who have spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit. Each episode peels back the layers to tell the stories of those who have found themselves caught in a legal system gone wrong. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling airs each Monday, and Jason Flom's episodes air on Thursdays. Please search, find, and follow Wrongful Conviction wherever you listen to podcasts. So where do I begin with this one? Like I mentioned in the intro, one of the biggest challenges of researching a case like this, which involves mammoth conspiracy theories, is that you're going to come across a lot of material out there, many of which has their own biased slant, and you have to figure out which sources are the most trustworthy. This was the same challenge I faced when I put together my two-part episode last year about the murders of Don Henry and Kevin Ives, aka the Boys on the Tracks case. Since the crime happened to take place in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was governor, the conspiracy theories in that case have spiraled out of control and have likely clouded the truth about what actually happened. In fact, if you search hard enough online, you'll find some sources out there which allege that Danny Casolaro came up with the infamous Clinton body count conspiracy, and he was murdered because his missing briefcase contained a list of all the people the Clintons had murdered. Given that Casolaro was looking into scandals which took place during Republican administrations, and his death occurred while George H.W. Bush was still president, I'm not entirely sure why the Clintons would want to have him murdered, but it just goes to show you that conspiracy theories can sometimes become larger than life. Now, regardless of whether Casolaro's death was a homicide or suicide, one thing I do believe is that the so-called octopus he was chasing did not actually exist, as I highly doubt there was this international cabal consisting of 8 men who pretty much controlled all the major events taking place in the world. This is why it's not so far-fetched to believe the theory that Casolaro spent so much time chasing down this labyrinthian story that he lost touch with reality and may have become so disillusioned by the fact that it didn't lead anywhere that he elected to take his own life. But on the other hand, even if this all-powerful octopus cabal didn't exist, Casolaro did spend a great deal of time and energy investigating scandalous events and interacting with shady characters, so could he have uncovered something which put his life in danger? Well, I first became familiar with this story on Unsolved Mysteries, and like many of their segments about suspicious suicides, I initially took everything the show presented at face value and automatically assumed that foul play had taken place. But of course, as the years have gone on, I've become more aware of the fact that Unsolved Mysteries had a tendency to take dramatic liberties in order to enhance the mysterious aspects of these stories. So some of these seemingly suspicious deaths they featured were probably suicides or accidents all along. There is a ton of material about the Danny Casolaro case available online, and one of the most valuable resources is the Bua Report, which was put together by Special Counsel Nicholas Bua as part of his in-depth investigation into the Inslaw scandal. The report has a very lengthy section detailing Casolaro's death, and quite frankly, if you read this report and take everything they say at face value, you'll come away believing that they make a lot of valid points and that Casolaro really did complete suicide. However, in recent years, the organization Muckrock has managed to get their hands on a number of additional documents from this case, which they believe call the legitimacy of the Bua Report into question. I'll share some specific examples later on, but some of the points made in the Bua Report do seem to be contradicted by handwritten notes from the original police investigation. That's the thing with conspiracy theories. Even though you'd assume that original government documents are the most reliable sources of information, what if they were intentionally skewing the facts in order to orchestrate a cover-up? I previously mentioned that two books have been published about this case, titled The Octopus, Secret Government, and the Death of Danny Casolaro, and The Last Circle, Danny Casolaro's Investigation into the Octopus and the Promise Software Scandal. It's clear that the authors of both books believe that Casolaro was the victim of foul play, and while the books are definitely interesting reads, they do tend to get sidetracked by spending a great deal of time detailing other government scandals and conspiracies which may or may not be connected to this case. One of the big decisions I had to make when putting together this episode is figuring how much of this side material should be included here and how much is completely unnecessary. So if you want to learn more details about the Inslaw scandal and some other shady stuff that was allegedly occurring on the Cabazon Native American Reservation during the 1980s, I'd recommend checking out those books, because I want to keep the focus on Casolaro's story. To further complicate things, Jim Keith, one of the co-authors of The Octopus, Secret Government, and the Death of Danny Casolaro, died under very odd circumstances only 3 years after the book's publication. In September of 1999, Keith fell from a stage and broke his knee at the Burning Man Arts Festival, which is being held in the Black Rock Desert in Nevada, and after he was taken to a hospital for knee surgery, a blood clot was released and entered Keith's lung, causing him to die from a pulmonary embolism. So as you can imagine, there are conspiracy theories out there that Keith was silenced because he knew too much, though there's nothing to indicate that his death was anything more than a tragic accident. Several years ago, Unsolved Mysteries released a couple of commercial DVD sets, and the Danny Casolaro segment was featured on their set about bizarre murders. The DVD contained a commentary track by the segment's original director, David Vassar, and it's quite fascinating to listen to, as he went in assuming that this was going to be your standard unexplained death segment, but the whole story just kept getting bigger and bigger. At one point, the producers thought they had locked the story and were ready to air it on television, until they were contacted by Michael Reconosciuto, who was still in jail on drug charges at that time. Reconosciuto had initially turned down the show's request for an interview, but then changed his mind 3 weeks after they finished putting together the segment, so of course, now they had to go back and film the interview and re-edit the whole thing. But of course, the big dilemma was, could you trust one word coming out of Reconosciuto's mouth? However, on the opposite side of the spectrum, the show managed to film an interview with Elliot Richardson, a man with impeccable credibility. Richardson had been United States Attorney General under President Richard Nixon until he made the decision to resign, rather than follow Nixon's order to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor who had been appointed to investigate the infamous break-in at the Watergate Hotel. At this point, Richardson had now become the official attorney for Inslaw and was representing them during their lawsuit against the Department of Justice in the Promise software case. During interviews, Richardson was never hesitant to express his belief that Danny Casolaro was murdered, and well, if a credible figure like him believes there was foul play, then this might not just be some fringe conspiracy theory. What's also interesting is that Casolaro's story also has a loose connection to a pair of other cold cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries and were also covered on episode number 20 of The Trail Went Cold. You might recall the bizarre unexplained death of 39-year-old Chuck Morgan, an escrow company owner who was found shot to death inside his car in the Arizona desert in June of 1977. Even though Morgan was shot in the back of the head and was wearing a bulletproof vest, his death was ruled to be a suicide. Morgan did hint to his wife that he was secretly doing undercover work for the Treasury Department to help them investigate money laundering which was being done through his escrow company through the purchase of gold bullion and platinum, and may have involved members of organized crime and the U.S. intelligence community. After the Morgan case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, they produced a follow-up episode about the murder of a 35-year-old computer draftsman named Doug Johnston, who was shot through the back of the head execution style inside his car in a parking lot of his place of employment in Phoenix in May of 1990. Since Johnston was an ordinary family man living an ordinary life, and his death resembled a professional hit, everyone was completely baffled by his murder, but it turned out that Johnston's place of employment just happened to be located across the street from the residence of Don Devereaux, an investigative journalist who had spent years working on the Morgan case. Devereaux was eventually told by sources that a contract hit had been put out on his life, and Doug Johnston may have been the victim of mistaken identity, because his killer went to the wrong address and shot Johnston because he thought he was Devereaux. If you want more information on these two cases, I'd recommend going back and listening to my Trail Went Cold episode, but here's the link to Danny Casalero's story. Sometime in 1991, Casalero actually got in touch with Don Devereaux and asked him to send all the information he had uncovered about illegal transactions Chuck Morgan had made involving gold bullion. But before Devereaux could do so, Casalero wound up dead. I honestly have no idea why Casalero would have been inquiring about material related to the Morgan case, unless he believed it was all part of some vast conspiracy involving the Octopus. I am inclined to think that Casalero's story has nothing to do with the deaths of Morgan or Johnston, but I felt it was worth mentioning anyway, since Unsolved Mysteries managed to produce three separate segments about three suspicious deaths, which all seem to have a tangential connection to each other. So now let's start talking about Danny Casalero as a person, as well as the circumstances surrounding his death. Whatever happened to him, it seems clear that Danny got in way over his head while trying to write this mammoth story about the Octopus, but was it because he uncovered something that angered some very powerful and dangerous people and put his life at risk? Or did he get in over his head because he was chasing a story which went absolutely nowhere? Regardless of your thoughts of how he handled the situation, it does seem like everyone who knew Danny had nothing but positive things to say about him as a person, as he was described as a ladies' man and a compassionate and tremendously nice guy who always went out of his way to treat people well. Even though the Octopus story seemed to be causing him a great deal of stress, his friends and family described him as being in an upbeat mood most of the time and believed he never would have contemplated the idea of suicide. However, I've seen enough of these cases to know that suicidal people will sometimes give off no warning signs and appear to be in a good place before they suddenly take everyone by complete surprise by ending their own life. So when you're dealing with a case involving a suspicious-looking suicide, it's best to focus on all the facts and evidence rather than the victim's demeanor, as you never really know what's going on inside a suicidal person's mind when they make a decision like this. One aspect of this story which does not seem to get a lot of discussion is Danny's son, Trey, who was mentioned in a suicide note. Danny got custody of Trey when he divorced his wife, and at the time of his father's death, Trey was 22 years old and living in Colorado. It's been reported that Danny and Trey had a good relationship, but there are virtually no details out there about Trey, and I've never seen him publicly comment on the whole situation. However, there are some key pieces of information which aren't mentioned in most sources about this case, but can be found in the Buell Report. When Danny and his housekeeper Olga were packing for his trip to Martinsburg, Olga asked if she should prepare the house for Trey, who would be visiting in 2 weeks, and Danny apparently replied that he would not be seeing his son anymore. Shortly thereafter, Danny took Olga into his basement office in order to show her where he kept his will. This could be seen as an indication that Danny was planning suicide, but on the other hand, if Danny legitimately believed that his life might be in danger, perhaps he was taking these steps to ensure that Trey was taken care of in the event something happened to him. A friend of Danny's named Zoe Gabrielle Milroy also claimed that several days before his death, he had shown her a letter he had written to Trey containing what he described as quote-unquote heavy fatherly advice. Milroy thought this letter seemed to resemble a suicide note, and when she asked Danny about this, he immediately changed the subject. So there definitely were signs that Danny might have been suicidal, but those who believe he was murdered have subscribed to the theory that his killer forced him to write the suicide note against his will, and one way they could have done that is if they threatened his son's life. It does seem very likely that the note was in Danny's handwriting, and a lot of significance has been placed on his final line, quote, God will let me in. Danny was known for being a very devout Catholic, and of course, suicide is considered to be a mortal sin in Catholicism, which could prevent you from getting into heaven. So could Danny have written this line to bring attention to the fact that he was under duress? Or maybe he just threw it in there to reassure his family that everything was going to be okay for him in the next life. I do think that Unsolved Mysteries kind of overplayed Casalero's status as an investigative journalist, as it's not like he was a Woodward and Bernstein type who wrote for a large publication like the Washington Post or the New York Times. He was a freelancer who had never been employed by a major news organization and mostly wrote for tabloids and computer trade publications. He had also written a short story collection and a fictional novel about mountain climbing titled The Ice King, though he apparently had to pay a vanity press to publish it, and the novel didn't do much for his writing career. For this octopus story, Casolaro was working without an editor or any oversight, which is why he had no success securing a book deal or getting any publishers to finance his investigation, as they found the material he provided to be amateurish and disorganized. The fact that Danny lied to some of his friends about getting a book deal might be a sign that he would have chosen suicide over professional failure. I mean, we are talking about a guy who once dropped out of college to search for ink and treasure in Ecuador, so as likable as he might have been, Danny may not have had the best judgment when it came to pursuing fame and fortune. Furthermore, being a freelance journalist meant that Danny wasn't generating any income from his investigation, and we know that he had a balloon mortgage payment of over $178,000 due on his house the month after he died. It seemed unlikely that he was going to get a large advance on a book deal or any significant income in order to pay that off in time. Yes, Danny's family have always maintained that he could always rely on them for financial assistance, which is why they don't believe his debts drove him to suicide, but $178,000 is a hell of a lot of money to borrow from someone. Danny gave off the impression that the so-called source he was planning to meet in Martinsburg would help him blow his big octopus story wide open. In fact, shortly before he left, he told one acquaintance that he was, quote-unquote, going to bring back the head of the octopus. But even if he genuinely believed that, Danny's behavior during his trip does suggest that he didn't quite get the information he was looking for. After all, even though Danny was described as usually being in an upbeat mood, one of the last eyewitnesses to interact with him was a bartender who said that Danny seemed depressed on the afternoon before he was found dead. Imagine if Danny was hit with the realization that he had wasted a year of his life chasing a story that was nothing more than a big white whale, and he did not have any options for pulling himself out of this hole. If this story was nothing more than a dead end, Danny's biggest flaw might have been allowing himself to be manipulated by some shady characters who were very unreliable sources. And of course, right at the top of that list was Michael Reconosciuto, his primary source on the Inslaw scandal and the octopus conspiracy. Now, I'm not one to judge a person based on their appearance, but if you look up any photos of Reconosciuto or watch any of his interviews, your first thought should be, if this guy told me it was raining outside, I would go to the nearest window to check for myself. In his article for Vanity Fair, Ron Rosenbaum described Reconosciuto as a quote-unquote rogue scientist slash weapons designer slash platinum miner slash alleged crystal meth manufacturer. Reconosciuto definitely has an interesting backstory, as he was a child prodigy who won a number of science fairs by constructing a working argon laser, which led to him becoming a research assistant at Stanford University at age 16. However, it sounds like his chances for a legitimate scientific career were derailed during the 1970s, when he spent 2 years in prison for manufacturing psychedelic drugs, though he always claimed that he was framed. Of course, only 8 days after submitting a sworn affidavit in the Inslaw investigation, Reconosciuto was arrested on drug charges again, though once again, he maintained that the Department of Justice framed him for speaking out. Indeed, Reconosciuto was already under investigation by the police in Tacoma, Washington, long before he submitted that affidavit, as he was manufacturing large quantities of methamphetamine from a makeshift lab at his home. When the Tacoma police reached out to federal authorities, they performed a sting operation in which they flat-out videotaped Reconosciuto delivering meth to his customers. So I do not believe his arrest on drug charges had anything to do with the Inslaw case, and the timing was just a coincidence. Now, like I mentioned earlier, performing an in-depth exploration into the entire Inslaw scandal would probably require another long-form podcast, so I'm not even going to attempt to do so here. But I will mention that the Buell Report was very critical of Inslaw's decision to use Reconosciuto as one of their key witnesses, as he frequently gave inconsistent statements in his various stories. For example, Reconosciuto stated on numerous occasions that he started working on the Promise software in 1981, which would have been impossible since Inslaw did not even license it to the DOJ until 1983. When addressing Reconosciuto's story that he installed quote-unquote back doors into Promise to spy on foreign governments, the Buell Report referred to it as a quote-unquote historical novel, a tale of total fiction woven against the background of accurate historical facts. When Reconosciuto was first arrested on the drug charges, Casolaro initially believed his claims that he was being framed, and even agreed to function as his volunteer pre-trial investigator. However, it sounds like Casolaro gradually became disillusioned with Reconosciuto and stopped communicating with him, as he refused to accept his phone calls from jail. By this point, Casolaro had developed a close relationship with another source named Robert Booth Nichols, and this guy is quite a colorful character on his own. Nicknamed Clark Gable because of his striking resemblance to the iconic actor, Nichols was believed to be an international money launderer who worked with the CIA on various intelligence operations. He also claimed to be an associate of the Gambino crime family and the Yakuza in Japan, though much like Riconosciuto, Nichols has been accused of fabricating a number of stories. As a side note, Nichols was also a friend of actor Steven Seagal and was hired to be the weapons technical advisor on Seagal's 1992 action film Under Siege. In fact, Nichols even has a brief cameo as a character named Colonel Sarnak, and you can briefly see him on camera during the scene where some nuclear-tipped missiles are fired at Honolulu, and he says the line, quote, "Approximately 1 million people will reach 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit in less than a second." The story goes that Nichols and Riconosciuto had worked together on the Cabazon Native American Reservation in order to develop the Promise software and weapons for the government, but they had a falling out sometime during the mid-1980s. In fact, it sounds like the two men attempted to play Casolaro off each other, as Nichols would warn him to stay away from Riconosciuto and vice versa. But it seems like Casolaro not only considered Nichols to be a trusted source, but a friend and father figure as well, as they had a number of lengthy phone conversations in the weeks prior to Denny's death, and Nichols reportedly warned him that if he continued on with his investigation, he would be putting his life at risk. Now, during this time period, Casolaro also had a conversation with Richard Stavin, a former special prosecutor with the Department of Justice, who said that Nichols had once offered to be a confidential informant for them against the mafia during the 1970s. In retrospect, Stavin feared that he may have endangered Casolaro's life by sharing this information. Due to his alleged associations with the Gambino crime family, the mere rumor that Nichols had once volunteered to be a snitch could have led to his death warrant being signed, so if Casolaro told him he found out about this, Nichols might have taken steps to silence him. However, it's worth noting that Nichols was never considered to be a suspect in Casolaro's death. On August the 9th, the day before Danny's body was found, Inslaw founder Bill Hamilton actually phoned Nichols in Los Angeles, who told him that Danny seemed, quote-unquote, euphoric the last time he spoke to him, and was excited about potentially cracking the octopus case. Shortly after the call ended, Nichols left on a flight to London, and given the timeline, it seems impossible that he could have been in Martinsburg on the morning of August the 10th, when Danny was believed to have died. But given the shady backgrounds of both Nichols and Riconosciuto, it's possible that both men were manipulating Casolaro by feeding him misinformation, which is why he spent so much time chasing after a conspiracy that had no basis in reality. But before we go into the details of Casolaro's death, we have to address another unsolved murder which took place 8 months earlier and is often mentioned in conjunction with this case. It's been reported that one of Casolaro's primary sources for classified information on the Octopus investigation was 34-year-old Alan Standorf, who worked for the National Security Agency at the Vint Hills Farm Station in Fauquier County, Virginia. On January the 31st, 1991, after not being heard from for 3 weeks, Standorf's body was found buried beneath some clothing and luggage on the back floor of his car, which was parked at Washington National Airport. He had been killed by a sharp blow to the back of the head, and since Standorf had withdrawn $500 from an ATM shortly before he went missing, and this money was never accounted for, it initially appeared that robbery was the motive for the crime. However, conspiracy theorists have speculated that Standorf was murdered because he was a whistleblower who was connected to the Octopus investigation, but there have been no new developments in the investigation in 3 decades, and the crime is still unsolved to this day. Now, unlike Casolaro's death, there is zero doubt that Alan Standorf was the victim of foul play, but there's no hard evidence to suggest that his murder has any connection to this case. It's possible that he was simply the victim of a robbery gone wrong, but since there's so little information available about the crime, it's hard to know for sure. I mean, if you try hard enough, you can uncover a tangential connection between 2 completely unrelated deaths and find a way to believe that they're all part of some massive conspiracy. However, I believe that the best way of figuring out what actually happened to Danny Casolaro is by following his movements and actions in the days prior to his death. One of the biggest pieces of evidence that has been used to further the narrative that Danny was murdered is that his missing briefcase, which supposedly contained important documents from his investigation, could not be found after he turned up dead. Danny's housekeeper, Olga Makros, did confirm seeing the briefcase at his residence when she helped him pack for his trip on August the 6th, but there has been controversy about whether or not this briefcase was ever in Martinsburg to begin with. The Buell report concludes that Danny never had one, as they claim that the only witness who recalled seeing a briefcase at the Sheraton Inn was the desk clerk, who wasn't even 100% sure he had seen it. The report says that none of the housekeepers at the hotel recalled seeing a briefcase in Danny's room during his stay there, but the website Muckrock disputes this. They managed to dig up the handwritten notes from the original police investigation, and they do state that Barbara Bittinger, the assistant head housekeeper, reported looking through the open doorway of Danny's room on August the 9th and seeing an open briefcase on the dresser with papers sticking out of it. So is this the result of some miscommunication? Or was the Buell report intentionally sharing false information in order to further their suicide narrative? Well, even if Danny had the briefcase all along, its absence is still not definitive proof that he was murdered. We'll talk more about the scenario later on, but if you believe Danny's death was a suicide, it's been theorized that he may have taken steps to intentionally make his suicide look like a homicide. In other words, he could have disposed of the briefcase himself in order to make everyone believe that someone murdered him in order to steal those important documents. Now, the documents that William Turner provided to Danny on the day before his death have also never been found, but we'll talk more about this momentarily. First, I want to talk more about Olga Makros, who claimed that she received a number of threatening phone calls at Danny's residence a few days after he left on his trip to Martinsburg. Once again, the Muckrock website has alleged that the Buell report contains false information, as the report claimed that Olga could only recall one specific incident when she received a threatening call at the house, even though Danny claimed they came on a frequent basis, and Olga went there nearly every day. But the handwritten notes from Olga's original police interview state that she had answered multiple threatening phone calls at the residence, which took place months prior to Danny's death. For this reason, Danny had advised Olga not to answer the phone, but she recalled him receiving a number of harassing phone calls after that. There's also been some controversy about whether these threatening phone calls might have been a fabrication on Danny's part, as one friend claimed that when he asked Danny why he didn't contact the phone company to trace the calls, Danny would just change the subject. If you believe Danny was orchestrating a hoax, you can assume that he was the one who made the threatening phone calls to Olga while he was in Martinsburg, but there's one problem with that theory. The last call Olga received, which featured a man saying, quote, "You're dead, you son of a bitch," took place at 8:30 p.m. on August the 10th, nearly 8 hours after Danny's body was found. So at the very least, someone else had to make that one call. But you also have to ask why they would be calling Danny's residence to threaten him after he was already dead. While we're on the subject of odd phone calls, now's a good time to make mention of Dan Bischoff, the editor from the Village Voice, who received an anonymous call on August the 11th from someone advising him to look into the death of a journalist in West Virginia who had been investigating the October surprise conspiracy. It seems obvious they were referring to Danny, but the problem is that his death was not made public until the following day. Hell, the Casalero family had not even been informed at this point, so only a handful of people would have known about what happened when Bischoff received that call. You can infer that the caller was personally involved in Danny's death or had some inside knowledge, but Bischoff was interviewed during the investigation for the Buell report, and he said that because of the nature of his job, it wasn't uncommon for him to receive weird phone calls from conspiracy buffs on his work line. While it's unclear how this caller would have known this information about Danny, Bischoff did state that he personally believed that Danny's death was a suicide, so he did not give the call all that much significance. So we know that Danny checked into the Sheraton Martinsburg on August the 8th and spent a large chunk of the afternoon drinking in their cocktail lounge, but there's been controversy about whether or not Danny met with someone there who might have been one of his sources. The waitress at the hotel lounge said that Danny spent some time drinking there with an unidentified dark-skinned man who looked Middle Eastern, but the bartender did not recall seeing this man. If you read the Buell report, they seem to put more credence into the bartender's account and believe that the waitress might have been mistaken, but the problem is that Olga reported seeing Danny speaking with a dark-skinned man in his kitchen on August the 5th. That just seems like too much of a coincidence, but assuming that Olga and the waitress both saw the same guy, who could he have been? Well, it's been theorized that he was a man named Hassan Ali Ibrahim Ali, the manager of an Iraqi company named Citico, which was supposedly a front for arms sales. In fact, shortly before he left on his trip, Danny had shown a copy of Ibrahim's passport photo to one of his friends. It's not entirely clear to me how this Ibrahim would fit into all this, but Danny believed that one of the scandals controlled by the Octopus was the Iran-Contra affair from the 1980s, where senior officials from the Reagan administration secretly facilitated the sale of arms to the Iranian government and then used the proceeds to fund the Contras in Nicaragua. I have no idea if Ibrahim, or whoever this Middle Eastern man was, might have been the important source Danny planned to meet in Martinsburg, or if this guy provided him with any important materials. But we do know that Danny spent the evening hanging out and drinking with a fellow hotel guest named Mike Looney and told him that he was waiting for an Arab who never showed up. So assuming that the Middle Eastern man that the waitress saw actually existed, was this Arab Danny referring to a completely different person? At one point, Casolaro excused himself and later told Looney that the source wasn't as valuable as he thought, so he may have gone off to make a phone call. But once again, was the source he was referring to the same Middle Eastern man or an entirely different source? Whatever the case, Casolaro's reaction gives off the impression that his trip to Martinsburg wasn't providing him with the big breakthrough he was expecting. It's worth noting that during his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Michael Reconosciuto stated that Danny had a source in the Internal Revenue Service's computer data center, which was located in Martinsburg, and the source was going to give him printouts of IRS information on certain individuals he was investigating. But of course, anything Reconosciuto says should be taken with a huge grain of salt, and there doesn't appear to be any evidence to support his claim. So it sounds like Danny's original plan was to only stay in Martinsburg for one night and drive back to Virginia in time to attend his niece's birthday party on the evening of August the 9th. But since he decided to extend his stay at the Sheraton for an additional night, what made him change his mind? Well, since Danny's meeting with William Turner took place on the afternoon of the 9th, that would seem to be the obvious answer, as Turner gave him important documents which supposedly went missing alongside Danny's briefcase. According to Turner, they detailed the mismanagement of funds between the Pentagon and his former employer, the Hughes Aircraft Company, though it's unclear how this was supposed to fit in with the Octopus investigation. However, the problem is that there are some credibility issues with Turner, and since he claimed his meeting with Casolaro took place inside a parked car with no other witnesses around, there's been skepticism about whether it actually took place at all. You see, Turner gave conflicting stories, as he initially said that he gave a pile of documents to Casolaro that was about 18 inches high, but then said that Casolaro was actually returning some sealed manila envelopes containing documents that Turner had given to him on a previous occasion. Furthermore, Turner was very inconsistent about the exact time the meeting took place, as he said it ranged from noon until 6 p.m., even though Casolaro could be placed in the Stone Crab Inn that afternoon between 2:30 and 5:30. Only 1 month after Casolaro's death, Turner would be arrested for robbing a bank in Gore, Virginia. Now, it turned out this whole thing was just a misunderstanding, as Turner had been a customer in the bank while it was robbed, and he was arrested after a witness mistakenly said they had seen Turner running away from the scene, which was not possible since Turner had a prosthesis after losing part of his left leg in a hunting accident. But while he was being detained in jail, Turner pleaded guilty to one felony count for an unrelated incident in which he made a false statement to the Veterans Administration in order to improperly defraud them of benefits back in 1988. He received a sentence of 60 days and 5 years probation, but in 1994, Turner wound up going back to prison for 6 months for violating his probation after 23 firearms were found in his home. So even if Turner really did provide some documents to Casolaro, was he actually a credible source? What is verifiable is that Danny spent a good chunk of the afternoon on August 9th drinking at the Stone Crab Inn, where he told the bartender that he had a quote-unquote rough night and was described as looking depressed. If his meeting with Turner actually took place, then this seems to imply that Danny may have been disappointed with the information Turner provided to him. If the meeting didn't take place, then perhaps Danny's disappointment was over his meeting, or lack thereof, with that other unidentified source the previous evening. The only other confirmed sightings of Danny that day are when he phoned his mother's residence from the payphone at 6 p.m. and was seen buying coffee at a convenience store shortly after midnight. Since his body was discovered about 12 hours later, there's a large window of time in which Danny's whereabouts are unaccounted for, so you definitely cannot rule out a homicide or suicide scenario. Of course, some of the biggest holes in the foul play theory is that there were no signs of struggle or forced entry in Danny's hotel room, and none of the guests in the adjacent rooms reported seeing or hearing anything unusual. So if Danny was murdered, he may have willingly let his killer or killers into the room and was taken by complete surprise. I can understand the logic of killing Danny and staging his death to look like a suicide, but there are some issues with that theory. For starters, Danny's wrists were slashed with a razor blade, which was taken from a package of blades that was found inside the room. Investigators were unable to track down where these blades were originally purchased, but it was a brand that was not available for sale in Martinsburg, so either Danny or a third party had to purchase them elsewhere and bring them to the hotel. But if Danny brought them, then the killer caught a lucky break that the victim just happened to have a convenient murder weapon in his possession. And if the killer brought them, why would they use one blade and leave the package behind as potential evidence? It's also strange that Danny was found with a shoelace wrapped around his neck and a pair of plastic trash bag liners in the bathtub. If his death was a suicide, then the implication seems to be that Danny might have made an attempt to asphyxiate himself, but when that didn't work out, he decided to slash his wrists instead. In fact, this could provide an explanation for why Danny went through with that, even though he was known for being squeamish about blood and needles. It's also worth mentioning that a box of hefty trash bags was found inside Danny's tote bag with two of the bags missing. Again, if this was a murder, why would his killer bring these bags to the scene and leave them behind in Danny's bag? A search of Danny's residence would also uncover two separate tennis shoes inside a closet, which were each missing a shoelace, and while these shoes could not be definitively linked to the lace found around Danny's neck or the second lace found in the bathtub, they were a close match. Another interesting detail is that Danny often liked to make mention of famous author Jerzy Kosinski, who died by suicide only 3 months earlier in May of 1991. Kosinski climbed into a bathtub full of water and ingested a lethal amount of drugs and alcohol before wrapping a plastic bag around his head. So if Danny had planned to end his own life in that fashion, then this might be where he got the idea from. I know there's been some controversy over the fact that Danny's body was embalmed without an autopsy being performed, but the medical examiner did extract a couple of blood and tissue samples before this happened. It does seem pretty clear that Danny was drinking a lot of alcohol before he died, as in addition to the half-empty bottle of wine, there were no less than 6 empty beer cans inside the room. But his family have always been troubled by the presence of an unknown antidepressant in his system. Danny was not known for taking antidepressants, and they were unable to figure out where this drug originated from, so could he have been forced to take something which incapacitated him? But on the other side of the coin, there was also a Vicodin in his system, and an empty Vicodin bottle was found in Danny's tote bag. The drug was originally prescribed to him when he underwent oral surgery 3 years earlier, so why would Danny be compelled to bring this along with him on his trip? Unless, of course, he was planning suicide and needed some drugs to numb the pain. However, while it sounds like I'm expressing a lot of skepticism about the homicide theory, one of the reasons I cannot completely discount it is because the photographs of the cuts on Danny's wrists are available for viewing online. Even though these photos are black and white, I have to say that the cuts on both of his wrists were incredibly deep, and of course one of them managed to sever a tendon. So Danny either inflicted 4 cuts on his right wrist before using that hand to slash his left wrist 8 times, or he inflicted 8 cuts on his left wrist and somehow used that hand to slash his right wrist 4 times while he had a severed tendon. I mean, while the medical examiner believed that Danny still would have been physically capable of doing this, I'm not entirely convinced, as at the very least, he would have been in excruciating pain, no matter what painkillers he might have had in his system. In fact, one of the paramedics who found Danny's body would make this statement for the article in Spy magazine, quote, "I've never seen such deep incisions on a suicide. I don't know how he didn't pass out from the pain after the first 2 slashes," end quote. But on the other hand, we are talking about a small, X-Acto razor blade, so maybe he would have had just enough arm strength to grasp it. Another complication is the allegations of bloodstained towels supposedly being found under the bathroom sink. Since these towels were never photographed or mentioned in any of the police reports, we cannot be 100% certain they existed, but Barbara Bittinger, the assistant head housekeeper, was certain she saw them there. Her story was also corroborated by one of the members of the cleaning crew, who claimed that he found these towels days later and threw them away. Since Danny's death had officially been ruled as a suicide by that point, There was no reason for him to believe this might be potential evidence. The way these towels were described, it almost appeared that someone had used them to make a half-assed attempt to clean blood off the floor, and what reason would Danny have to do this after slashing his own wrists? Well, I'm sure that many of you are familiar with Dr. Henry Lee, who is one of the world's most famous blood spatter analysts, and he would be brought in as a consultant to share his expert opinion on the case. The Martinsburg Police Department actually went to the trouble of putting together a videotaped reenactment of Danny's suicide, though this video has never been released publicly. But based on the reenactment and other evidence, Dr. Lee came to the conclusion that Danny's death was, quote-unquote, not inconsistent with suicide. However, years later, when Lee learned about the presence of the bloody towels under the sink, he began to question his earlier conclusion and expressed his disappointment that the authorities never provided him with all the key pieces of evidence for his analysis, stating, quote-unquote, a reconstruction is only as good as the information supplied by the police. Of course, Henry Lee is not infallible, so his analysis doesn't prove anything either way. But even though the Boole report agreed with the original suicide ruling, they did acknowledge that the original police investigation was not handled well. But I wouldn't take that as an indication that the Martinsburg Police Department were part of some mammoth conspiracy to cover up Casalero's death. Martinsburg is not an overly large city, as it only had a population of around 14,000 at that time, so I'm guessing the local police may have had little experience with homicide investigations, and probably had no inkling that this would balloon into such a massive story. Every good investigator will tell you that you should always treat each death scene as a potential homicide at the beginning, and only start leaning towards suicide or accident if that's where the evidence leads you. Unfortunately, the Martinsburg PD did not do that, but since they found a suicide note at the scene and no visible signs of struggle, you can understand why they would have reached the conclusion that they did and overlooked some odd discrepancies. The bruises on Danny's body, as well as the missing tips on three of his fingernails, have never been adequately explained and may point towards the presence of an outside party, but unfortunately, these details were not even noticed until a second autopsy was performed months after the fact. And even if you believe this was a suicide, one of the biggest points in favor of that theory, the possible symptoms of multiple sclerosis in Danny's brain, was not found until the second autopsy, when it really should have been noticed the first time around. Of course, it still seems pretty sketchy that Danny's body was embalmed without permission from his family, but Martinsburg did actually have a policy in which they performed what they described as quote-unquote courtesy embalmings for decedents from other localities. And this decision may have been born out of laziness as well, as the local undertaker flat out said that he went through with embalming Danny on the Saturday his body was found because he quote-unquote didn't want to come back to work on Sunday. The Casalero family did attempt to file a lawsuit against the funeral home and the city of Martinsburg for this decision, but it was ultimately dismissed. Now, it is pretty ridiculous that the Casaleros were not informed about Danny's death until Monday, 2 days after he died, but this wasn't entirely the fault of the Martinsburg PD. Since Danny lived out of state, the Martinsburg PD informed the Fairfax County Police Department about his death and asked them to inform next of kin. An officer from the Fairfax County PD went to Danny's residence, but since he lived alone, no one answered the door, so the officer left behind a business card asking them to get in touch. Yes, the Fairfax County PD should have tried harder to track down other members of Danny's family that day rather than waiting another 2 days, but again, it seems clear that the delay in notification was born out of laziness rather than an intentional attempt to orchestrate a cover-up. So I suppose now would be a good time to talk about what I consider to be one of the biggest WTF moments I've ever seen in an unsolved mystery, and that's the appearance of the unidentified military man at Danny's funeral, who placed a medal on his casket and saluted him before walking away. Now, you might be wondering why no one else at the funeral went over and attempted to speak with this guy, but Danny was being laid to rest at this point, and I'm sure everyone was grief-stricken and did not want to be the person who spoke out and made a scene. I think there was an assumption that somebody from the funeral would know who the military man was, but it was only after talking amongst themselves that they realized no one did. A lot of people have pointed out that the actor who was cast to play the military man in the Unsolved Mystery segment looked an awful lot like Colin Powell, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time, but I seriously doubt it was him, as I'm sure he would have been recognized. But since the man showed up to the cemetery in a limousine and had what appeared to be a bodyguard with him, He gave off the impression of being a high-profile individual. One theory is that this man could have been a source that Danny spoke to during his octopus investigation, and if he admired what Danny was doing, he could have decided to pay his respects by showing up to the funeral and placing a medal on Danny's casket, even though he never served in the military. Of course, if the military man was a source, showing up to a funeral in a limousine in front of hundreds of people isn't exactly the best way to keep a low profile. And if he had admiration for Danny, why not offer his condolences to his loved ones or even speak to them at all? As goofy as this might sound, perhaps the simplest explanation is that the military man showed up at the wrong funeral. For all we know, there could have been another funeral taking place at the cemetery that day for a fallen veteran, but the man got confused and placed the medal on the wrong casket without even realizing it. That seems like an incredibly bizarre thing to do, but this is an incredibly bizarre case, so I'm sure anything's possible. Unfortunately, it's unclear to me if any attempt has ever been made to dig up the medal and check it for potential evidence, such as fingerprints. If the whole thing was just a misunderstanding and the military man has no connection to this case, he has never come forward to confirm this. Okay, so if Danny's death really was a homicide, who could have been responsible for personally carrying out his murder? Well, conspiracy theorists have always pointed the finger at a U.S. Army Special Forces covert intelligence officer named Joseph Cuellar. During his investigation into the Insulaw scandal, Danny had been trying to arrange an interview with Peter Vidinieks, who had been a Department of Justice contracting officer when they acquired the Promise software during the 1980s. Michael Raconte-Schnudo claimed that Vidinieks had attempted to threaten him into not cooperating with the House Judiciary Committee, but Casolaro had no luck attempting to speak with Vidinieks. However, just over 2 months before his death, Casolaro was hanging out in a bar in Arlington when he had a chance encounter with Joseph Cuellar. After they started up a conversation, Casolaro mentioned wanting to interview Peter Vidinieks, and Cuellar responded by saying that he knew him and could make it happen. Even though Casolaro told friends that he was a bit unnerved by the coincidence, he still kept in touch with Cuellar, though the interview with Vidinieks never came to fruition. Well, around this time period, Cuellar started dating Lynn Knowles, a friend of Danny's who had been hanging out with him at the bar on the night he met Cuellar. Following Danny's death, Cuellar reportedly made a veiled threat to Lynn and told her that she was asking too many questions about Danny and could end up just like him. And according to William Turner, when he met with Danny in Martinsburg on August the 9th, Danny told him that he was going to another meeting later that night, which had been arranged by Cuellar. Well, according to the Buell report, Cuellar was investigated as a possible suspect in Casolaro's death, but was cleared since he had an alibi during the time period Casolaro was believed to have been killed. Cuellar had recently returned from having served in Operation Desert Storm, and on the morning of August the 10th, he was reportedly in Washington, D.C., working on his out-processing from Desert Storm and his in-processing into the United States Southern Command. Cuellar's alibi was corroborated by several witnesses, but once again, the Muckrock website has accused the Buell report of publishing false information and has pointed out some discrepancies. One issue is that the exact time of Casolaro's death was believed to have been during the early morning hours, and since a drive from Martinsburg to Washington, D.C. takes just over an hour and a half, Cuellar theoretically still could have killed Danny and traveled to Washington that day to be seen by witnesses. Muckrock also points out that a few weeks before Danny's death, Cuellar had already gone to Panama to report for duty there. But the problem is that at the time, the United States Southern Command had jurisdiction over operations in Panama, so this meant that Cuellar should have already completed his in-processing into the Southern Command and would not have needed to be in Washington, D.C. to go through the procedure on the morning of August the 10th. But regardless of whatever issues there might be with Cuellar's alibi, there does not seem to be any hard evidence placing him in Martinsburg at the time of Casolaro's death. So what exactly did happen here? Well, I think it's possible that when Casolaro started his investigation on the Insulaw scandal, he was initially pursuing a legitimate story involving illegal activities, but after being led on a wild goose chase by such sketchy figures as Michael Raconte-Schnudo and Robert Booth Nichols, he wound up becoming entrapped with this larger-than-life octopus conspiracy and found it more difficult to separate fantasy from reality. Don't get me wrong, even though I don't believe this octopus actually existed, I can't completely discount the possibility that Casolaro uncovered something he shouldn't have, which put his life in danger. But I think it probably would have been connected with standard criminal activity rather than an all-powerful international cabal. However, no matter how insistent Danny's loved ones might have been about him never going through the act of suicide, it is not unprecedented for suicidal people to intentionally make their deaths look as strange as possible in order to create the false impression that they were victims of foul play. As an example, last year I released an episode about the 2004 death of Richard Lancelin Green, the world's foremost Sherlock Holmes scholar, who was found dead in his flat in London after he was garroted with a shoelace that was wrapped around his neck with a wooden spoon. To this day, opinions are still sharply divided about whether his death was a suicide or homicide, but since there was no hard evidence pointing in either direction, the coroner could only return an open verdict. But if Lancelin Green's death was a suicide, then it makes sense for a Sherlock Holmes fanatic to kill himself in a mysterious manner that would stump Sherlock Holmes himself. I mean, look at the state of Danny Casalero's life when he died. He was in financial trouble after having spent the past year chasing a story which he thought was going to launch his writing career and make him money, but he was just not having his expected level of success. And while it's up for debate, just how serious Danny's early symptoms of multiple sclerosis were, it's been reported by some of his friends that he complained about vision problems, and they would witness him have issues with such physical tasks such as opening a window and painting a house. Danny was known as a guy who loved life and lived it to the fullest, so the prospect of a future where he suffered through a debilitating disease like MS may have been another contributing factor in his decision to end his own life. I mentioned earlier that Danny and his family were very devout Catholics who likely considered suicide to be a taboo subject. They had already gone through the pain of losing his sister Lisa to a drug overdose years earlier, so if Danny wanted to end his life, he may have elected to arrange things so that everyone would believe he was murdered. When he told his brother, quote, "If anything happens to me in Martinsburg, don't believe it was an accident," Danny could have been planting the seeds for this, and if that was his plan all along, he technically succeeded, since his family have always rejected the official suicide ruling. Regardless of what your personal opinion is on Danny's death, you cannot deny that it has been endlessly dissected and analyzed these past three decades. So in essence, if he made the calculated choice to stage an intentionally bizarre suicide, Danny ensured that he would be remembered, and his death allowed him to achieve the fame he never attained in life. Following his death, a bunch of Danny's research files and notes were found in his office at his home, and they are available for viewing online, though his writings are pretty disorganized and do not offer much insight into his death. While some of Danny's notes contain cryptic reference to germ warfare and mad cow disease, and they seem to imply that he may have believed that he had become a victim of biological warfare, which may have been causing some of his symptoms of multiple sclerosis. However, in his aforementioned Vanity Fair article, I think Ron Rosenbaum summed up this whole situation perfectly when he wrote, quote, "I believe that in a sense, Danny was correct when he worried that he might have been targeted with a slow-acting brain virus. Not exactly the organic virus he worried about, not mad cow disease or multiple sclerosis. Rather, I believe what destabilized Danny was an extremely virulent strain of the information virus we've been suffering from collectively as a nation, conspiracy theory fever. A slow-acting virus that has infected our ability to know the truth about the secret history of our age," end quote. And boy oh boy, in today's internet age, does that quote have even more relevance now than it did back then. In that same article, Rosenbaum pointed out a number of flaws in the murder theory, but he also acknowledged that there were a number of flaws in the suicide theory, and that neither scenario made 100% complete sense. And I'm definitely inclined to agree with that. Of course, back when I first became familiar with this case 3 decades ago, I immediately believed that Danny was murdered, but I've changed my stance over the years and spent this episode sharing a number of reasons why the suicide theory makes more sense overall. But I still believe there are some odd discrepancies which cannot be adequately explained, such as the missing briefcase, the bloody towels, the additional bruises, and the threatening phone call Olga received after Danny was already dead. Sometimes, I'll reach a point where I firmly believe this was a suicide, but then second-guess myself when I go back and look at the photos of the deep cuts on Danny's wrists. Whatever happened, I think this story has become so engulfed in conspiracy theories that it would be difficult to figure out what actually took place here. All that being said, this is still a very fascinating mystery, and I would love for Danny's family and friends to receive some answers someday. So if you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Danny Casalero, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about an infamous case from Unsolved Mysteries. The disappearance of Anne Sigmund, who became a wanted fugitive for the murder of her estranged husband, Charlie Sigmund, and she has not been seen in 35 years. In addition, I've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1988 murder of Philip Fraser. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Catherine C. and Dominic F. Thank you so much for your support. Next month, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Westin Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes. So in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music here on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.